Hello, this is Dale Doherty, and welcome to the Maker File. In this session, recorded in Brussels, Belgium, we talked to James Larson, author of the famous VCR Cat Feeder and Gentleman Maker.
At Eurofoo and various other places, you have given a talk called The Sex Life of Gate Arrays.
Life of Logic Gates, yes. That's becoming my staple.
Can you give us the one-minute version of that?
Not on audio. It's an entirely visual thing. But I have, let's say it finishes with a diagram which is quite dirty if you understand Boolean algebra. And some people think it's a little bit risque and not proper for presentation. Given that it's entirely diagrammatic.
You can measure your passion for electronics by the ton, right?
Yeah. I think I live in a hole filled with rusting electronic equipment, mostly old computers, but there's also old test equipment and militaria and what have you. And it's easier to think of it in terms of tonnage rather than any other metric.
Tell us some of the things you have in your basement.
I have, apart from just about every 8-bit computer from the late 1970s that I wanted as a child and couldn't have, and now in a kind of sad older life, I've decided to recreate my passion for you know, coding in 6502 or Z80 or what have you. I also have things like a section of a 1950s flight simulator, which is an entirely mechanical computer. And it was cool about flight simulators in that the first generation were actually a flying camera, and it was a robotic arm with a video camera mounted on it. And the camera would pan and tilt as if an aircraft were going up and down, and it would fly over a physical model of terrain, of an airfield, of enemy territory, or what have you. And there'd be little models of trees and houses and landing strips and what have you. And that meant the image quality was really, really good and far superior to the first generation of CGI-based flight simulators. And the other cool thing about this is that it was the only technology of flight simulator which you could genuinely crash, because you could crash the camera into the ground or a model or something like that. So there was no messing around. You had to really learn to fly that thing.
What period was that from?
That was 1956. And it's a triumph of gears and zero backlash mechanical technology.
So where do you find most of this technology that you end up purchasing?
Nowadays, because I'm lazy, it's eBay. But previously, I'd have quite a high carbon footprint looking at government surplus auctions and scrap yards and things like that. I still go to the odd scrap yard.
Right. You and Bree were last night working on Bree's drawing robot here. You've done your video on it, but it still needs some work. Is that right?
Well, the cool thing is that James brought this amazing visual tachometer, which I can only describe as, it's like, I thought it was going to be huge when he described it, because he said it was like a box filled with tuning forks. So I was imagining like 2 feet by 2 feet. But he pulls it out of his briefcase, and it's like the size of I don't know, it's maybe four of a brick, yeah. And it's got little like wiggly bits inside it that resonate at certain frequencies, and we put it on the drawbot and made just these amazing little, it just started making these amazing patterns. So great.
It's a lovely example of a simple technology that has been passed over because it's superseded by electronics. If one thinks of, let's say you've got something in the low audio band and you want to know what frequency it is, nowadays, everyone is going to measure it digitally, you know, count the pulses relative to a time period. And there are other ways of doing it, like frequency to voltage conversion. And if you've got really trained ears, maybe you can hear 338 hertz or, you know, something like that. I'm sure there are some musicians who can indeed do that. But before all this stuff, other than the hearing, was commonplace, it was done through the really elegant principle of resonance. And you a technique developed by someone called Frahm, I don't know what his first name, F-R-A-H-M, would have this array of tuning forks with brightly colored ends, and when the thing that was mechanically coupled to vibrated in one of these tuning forks would vibrate in sympathy, and you'd see the vibration. And it's very neat to look at.
When I visited you, you showed me a sort of post-Enigma encryption box.
Yes, that's ciphering machines of yesteryear. One had a hand crank, and you'd set up the keys manually on some routers, and every time you wanted to cipher a single letter, because it was an entirely mechanical system, you had to crank it, and it made a ka-chunk noise, and laborious but reasonably secure for its age. It's a descendant of the Enigma machine.
Right. So, I mean, you're kind of a master of lost art in a certain way.
I'm not sure a master, definitely an enthusiast and, yeah. Or keeper and custodian of.
Right. What do you find fascinating in all? What ties this stuff together, other than it's old?
Well, I like new stuff too, and you know, let that be on the record. the things about old stuff are much of it is visible, whereas you can have something incredibly cool, like the device that this interview is being recorded on. You crack it open, you see a few ICs, they're black plastic blobs with legs, and you can see none of the functioning. If you contrast that to the mechanical flight simulator, where every single process is visible, that's an extreme contrast. But, for instance, I have in my collection some of the first desktop calculators, electronic calculators from the 1960s, and they're not mechanical, they're purely electronic, but they're discrete component, and they are, this is, for instance, like the HP 9100A, lots of pictures of that on the web. Entirely discrete component. Every single transistor is visible, every resistor. You can see this bit is registers, this bit is ROM, this bit is RAM, this drives the display. And even if you don't understand electronics, the fact that it takes so much stuff to achieve quite simple calculation, this calculator just does the basic arithmetic, some programmable functions and trigonometry and logarithms, which is, you know, a decent scientific calculator, but it's the kind of thing you buy for a few dollars. When you see what's inside it and what sort of technology is needed to achieve that function, you go, oh, wow. And that has now just been shrunk onto a chip, and you open the calculator now and you see one black plastic blob, and you don't say, oh, wow.
A bit of detective work in figuring out how these old machines work, isn't there?
I think you have to want to do it. Yeah, I fixed a discrete component calculator once, which was that one transistor had failed somewhere, and that was a little bit laborious to go through each one with an oscilloscope. Oh, please, may it be this next one. I've only done, you know, 800 transistors so far.
Right. What kind of projects are you working on these days? Do you have any recent things?
I like old stuff. I also like very silly stuff. And one of my mottos is competitive advantage through stupidity. And I saw this wonderful thing, Nixie tubes. Everybody who's ever seen a Nixie tube thinks they're great. And I saw this Nixie tube digital watch, and the first thought was, I can't replicate this because it's terribly clever, the tubes are unavailable, and I can't do better than this. And so then my only hope is to do something very much worse than this. So I thought I'd make the world's largest Nixie tube digital watch with discrete component counting circuitry, a mechanical rotary voltage converter. So it's a motor dynamo, because Nixie tubes need to fire at 100 volts or so, or sometimes higher. And so a rotary mechanical voltage converter, as opposed to, you know, nice little DC to DC converter. So I thought I'd do this really stupid. And it looks like the Borg from Star Trek. It's this arm, which is entirely filled with largely clunky electronics, and it moves. And it's all to make these four little tubes light up. And so it's my Borg watch.
It's a bit the long way around.
Yeah, on purpose. Yes.
You're also at least a participant in the London Dorkbot and kind of a regular there. Can you tell us what happens in this chapter?
The London Dorkbot is kind of my spiritual home, and lots of like-minded people there who do strange things with electricity, which is the Dorkbot mission. And it's fabulous that there's an environment for people just to play, make things and play. Everything you can imagine and more goes on at Dorkbot. I do a lot of stuff there, a lot of purposefully stupid stuff, which hopefully some people find amusing. There's a guy there called Mike Harrison, otherwise known as Dr. High Voltage, who makes things like million volt Marx generators and sparks that are, I don't know how many feet across, but many, and Tesla coils and Jacob's ladders, with the added bonus of being filled with butane. So if the spark isn't good enough, you get an enormous mushroom cloud of fire at the top. And there are a lot of people who do music projects with software and algorithmic generated music, and it's.
What was the keyboard?
There was a music performance at the beginning of this year by a group called Strange Attractor, who get musical keyboards, really cheap ones. The object being disposable, because they don't last long once they've been played, and rather than playing them by pressing the keys, they get quack electric medical instruments called violet rays, which discharge high voltage, meant to discharge high voltages through the skin and cure various ailments. But instead of curing ailments on human beings, this causes damage on musical keyboards. And so they play the keyboards with the violet ray. There's a lot of sparks. The control chips in them, the keyboards go berserk and die, but in quite a musical and amusing fashion. I was there when this happened with some representatives of an engineering union who were just checking out Dorkbot because they'd heard about it, and they were quite conservative gentlemen, and I think they thought this was utterly repulsive. The idea that this was any way good was something that was outside their frames of reference. It was really quite fun to see the look of horror on their faces.
Just on a practical level, how often does the London Dorkbot meet, and where roughly?
London Dorkbot meets in East London. It's supposed to be monthly. They occasionally drop a month. But it's dorkbot.org/dorkbotlondon, and check it out.
Okay. Bree, do you have any questions for James?
I was just wondering, like, you've got a lot of old equipment, and I'm wondering if you've had any, like, major disasters, whether intentional or non-intentional, that have, like, equipment disasters. Have you had any equipment disasters recently?
I've had lots of disasters. I like to frame them as being intentional. I tried to replicate some of the butane experiments, which I didn't realize quite what difficult gas it is to work with and how it likes to eat through various things that one would normally think would be able to contain it. So don't play with butane, kids, or high voltages.
But if you do come to London Dorkbot.
You're
not alone.
You're definitely not alone. I tried to. There's a terrible TV program, and I wanted to rig up a system that would blow up an old TV on cue, which again is something you shouldn't do. And it, the audio system triggered rather more easily than I had predicted. That nearly turned nasty, but nothing's really let me down. And, given the number of software crashes that you get on modern stuff, old stuff is quite robust.
Was this butane related to the burning dork?
The example that I cited actually relates to. Oh dear! I have to reveal. The thing is that I'm British, and British people have a very lavatorial sense of humor. And
lavatorial, look that one up.
And this, I had beginning to realize that this is a particular quirk, and I say sort of laboratorial techno jokes to other British people, and they find it really funny. And then I say it to someone from another country, and they sort of blink, you know, what's happening? And yes, I felt that these Japanese laboratories that do everything, very, very high tech, expensive things, including medical analysis, and it's hard to. Think of where that technology can go, because the more advanced ones really do everything that the Japanese creators have thought of. And so I guess I must have been watching an episode of South Park or something immediately before feeling challenged in this way. And I thought, well, what you really need to do, and what these Japanese laboratories never do, is light your farts. And so what you need... I need to do a hack on my lavatory at home that does the aforementioned function, and yeah, it worked fine. And I then wanted to exhibit this at Dorkbot, but being unable to actually produce the right gas at will, and wanting it to be quite visible in front of a couple of hundred people, butane seemed to be a good alternative to methane, but it was hard to work with and. Yes, it was not the organizers. It was the first time the organizers actually frowned with disapproval at my lack of safety.
Yes. Another ill-conceived project from Jane Larson.
Yes, quite.
Well, thank you, James. I appreciate taking time to talk to us.
You're welcome.